Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Red Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray, and today we're talking about a selection of short stories by Roald Dahl. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy!
There was this deep, curling river of black that ran clear across the width of the carpet, and he was forced by his position to cross it at its widest part. He thought first of trying to jump it, but decided he couldn't be sure of landing accurately on the narrow band of yellow on the other side. He took a deep breath, lifted one foot, and inch by inch he pushed it out in front of him, far, far out, then down and down, until at last the tip of his sandal was across and resting safely on the edge of the yellow. He leaned forward, transferring his weight to his front foot. Then he tried to bring the back foot up as well. He strained and pulled and jerked his body, but the legs were too wide apart, and he couldn't make it. He tried to get back again. He couldn't do that either. He was doing the splits, and he was properly stuck. He glanced down and saw this deep, curling river of black underneath him. Parts of it were stirring now, and uncoiling, and beginning to shine with a dreadfully oily glister. He wobbled, waved his arms frantically to keep his balance, but that seemed to make it worse. He was starting to go over. He was going over to the right. Quite slowly, he was going over, then faster and faster, and, at the last moment, instinctively, he put out a hand to break the fall, and the next thing he saw was this bare hand of his going right into the middle of a great, glistening mass of black, and he gave one piercing cry as it touched. Outside in the sunshine, far away behind the house, the mother was looking for her son. Hello, hey. Ren.
Hi, Adam. Thank you for your excellent reading of the ending of The Wish by Roald Dahl.
And today we are looking at a little menagerie of Roald Dahl stories, focusing on his collection The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar and Six More, which doesn't include The Wish, but it's one of his short stories that features a child protagonist. And the Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar collection was aimed at slightly older readers than his children's fiction. So mine belongs to the Puffin Teenage Fiction imprint. Do you have the same edition? I've got Henry Sugar looking very toothsome and nose-pronounced, leaning out from his balcony, throwing money to assembled people below.
No, I had a different one, although I have currently mislaid it chaotically. Don't know where my copy has gone.
Can you remember what's on the cover?
I mean, it's sort of a collection of objects. Dice.
That sounds like what you've lost it among.
Yeah. I'm looking on Google to see if I can see the copy though.
I mean if there were objects from the book, there might be a turtle, maybe, or a swan.
I think it was like cards and dice.
Okay, so that might relate possibly to The Hitchhiker? That relates to The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar.
Yeah.
There's card playing and that.
The gambling-related paraphernalia, I think, yeah.
There's a story called A Piece of Cake, which doesn't actually feature Bruce Bogtrotter's famous chocolate cake. And there's also The Hitchhiker, which doesn't have many objects in. It's got a kind of classic car.
Oh, okay, yeah. So my copy has a classic car on the cover.
Okay. Oh, it does. Okay.
Yeah, two dice and an ace of spades.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and some kind of the background is like some writing in a letter. So, yeah.
Oh, and if listeners, you're sorry, I'm not going to point at your ears, but. If you're listening, expecting a discussion of Wes Anderson's The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar, that's yet to be released. But don't go away, because near the end of the episode, we will make predictions. Probably very canny and accurate predictions, I would assume, about Wes Anderson's upcoming Netflix adaptation of this book. Well, of the title story, The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar, and three of the other stories within. And actually, there's seven stories in this collection, so we'll have a guess later which of the stories Wes Anderson is going to be adapting, because some of these stories are much more horrible than others, and this is a children's horror podcast, so we're going to be focusing on the more macabre side of Roald Dahl's writing.
And this was a listener suggestion. It was Dave, again. Thank you, Dave. And he specifically mentioned in his email the story The Swan being the one that struck him as the most horrible. I think that's the one we picked out too. As a story described by one Goodreads reviewer as a piece of sadistic filth.
Which is not wholly characteristic. Mostly this is quite a whimsical collection, I would say. They're kind of flights of fancy with elements of grotesquerie, which is how I normally think of Roald Dahl's writing for children. Mm-hmm. Like, if I think of James and the Giant Peach, or even The Witches. We've discussed The Witches on the podcast before, and The Witches is all sorts of frightening bits. I couldn't even cope with having the copy of the book in my bedroom as a kid. I had to have it moved out of the room to sleep. But actually, on rereading it, there's quite a lot of mouse antics, basically.
Yeah.
You know, once the kids get turned into mice, they have a pretty jolly time of it. They get to do a little mouse tightrope. There's horrible stuff in there, but there's a lot of whimsy. The Swan, however, is not a very whimsical tale, I think it's fair to say. Did you want to do a kind of basic
plot? Yeah, well, I've got a fairly extended plot recap of it, but we can... You can interject as I go along. But it starts with a boy called Ernie who gets given a 22 caliber rifle for his birthday and told by his father to bring back a rabbit for supper. Ernie is a big lout of a boy, as Dahl says, and a real wrong'un, and has a father who's a truck driver. So what do you expect is the kind of implication that Dahl... is putting across, but
he's definitely characterized as like a working class oink.
He meets up with his equally loutish friend Raymond for an afternoon of shooting innocent creatures, but after they've shot various birds, they come across Peter Watson, who's
the bird shooting did remind me of The Magic Finger, which is a kind of lesser known Roald Dahl.
Unsettling one, that.
Yeah, not quite horror, but definitely unsettling, in which a family who like to hunt are kind of transformed into wildfowl, possibly ducks.
Yeah.
And again, a shot at. And I think reading this story, you expect that there might be some kind of turning the tables or justice coming down the road for these two young bully boys. But we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Peter Watson is a small, bespectacled, sensitive boy who, it said, his father did not drive a truck or work in a factory. He worked at the bank. So it's not a particularly subtle story. But Ernie and Raymond
torment Peter to the extent of tying him up on the railway tracks in the path of an oncoming train.
And this is a lot less whimsical than it was in those old silent films.
Yeah.
That's back then it was a lark, but in this story it seems quite unpleasant. And it really ratchets up the tension. Actually, this is quite a slow section of the story.
Mm.
And what I liked here is there's a lot of kind of internal narration.
Mm-hmm.
Describing how, is it Peter, did he say?
Yeah.
Or yeah, describing how Peter Watson feels as he's tied to the tracks, and he realises quite quickly that Raymond and Ernie aren't joking around. They're quite willing to see him run over and killed by a train.
Yeah.
And can I read the section when he's...
Oh yeah, please.
Yeah. So it describes him for this sort of agonising few paragraphs, just laying there trying to distract himself, watching the clouds, waiting for this train to come. And then, quite suddenly, he heard a curious little vibrating sound coming from the rails on either side of him. It was very soft, this sound, scarcely audible, a tiny little humming, thrumming whisper that seemed to be coming along the rails from far away. That's a train, he told himself. The vibrating along the rails grew louder, then louder still. He raised his head and looked down the long and absolutely straight railway line that stretched away for a mile or more into the distance. It was then that he saw the train. At first it was only a speck, a faraway black dot. But in those few seconds that he kept his head raised, the dot grew bigger and bigger, and it began to take shape, and soon it was no longer a dot, but the big, square, blunt front end of a diesel express. Peter dropped his head and pressed it down hard into the small hole he'd dug for it in the gravel. He swung his feet over to one side. He shut his eyes tight and tried to sink his body into the ground. The train came over him like an explosion. It was as though a gun had gone off in his head, and with the explosion came a tearing, screaming wind that was like a hurricane blowing down his nostrils and into his lungs. The noise was shattering. The wind choked him. He felt as if he were being eaten alive and swallowed up in the belly of a screaming, murderous monster.
Whew. Yeah.
It's a pretty merciless description. He doesn't pull his punches here.
Yeah, Peter manages to survive being run over by a train. And that's not enough for Raymond and Ernie.
Or for Roald Dahl.
For Roald Dahl, no. right, more torment of this poor boy. And it's kind of only after we've got that we get to the swan of the title, which Ernie sees and shoots and then forces Peter to retrieve the corpse from the pond. And this is kind of finally what makes Peter snap, because he's been sort of very, very collected and kind of trying to wait it out and hope that they'll get bored of tormenting him. But he shouts at them and says, he calls them a couple of ignorant idiots and says, it's you who ought to be dead instead of the swan. You're not fit to be alive. And that really works Ernie up. And he says, so you like swans? And he proceeds to cut off the wings of the dead swan and tie them onto Peter's arms. And then he makes Peter climb to the top of a tall weeping willow and tells him that he's going to fly from the top. And Peter thinks that he can finally escape them at the top of the tree. But of course he can't, and Ernie starts shooting at him with a rifle. So Peter jumps. And this is the end of the story. three different people reported seeing a great white swan circling over the village that morning. A schoolteacher called Emily Mead, a man who was replacing some tiles on the roof of the chemist shop, whose name was William Isles, and a boy called John Underwood, who was flying his model airplane in a nearby field. And that morning, Mrs. Watson, who was washing some dishes in her kitchen sink, happened to glance up through the window at the exact moment when something huge and white came flopping down onto the lawn in her back garden. She rushed outside and sank down on her knees beside the small crumpled figure of her son. "Oh, my darling," she cried, near to hysterics and hardly believing what she saw. "My darling boy, what happened to you?" "My leg hurts," Peter said, opening his eyes. Then he fainted. "He's bleeding," she cried, and she picked him up and carried him inside. Quickly, she phoned for the doctor and the ambulance, and while she was waiting for help to come, she fetched a pair of scissors and began cutting the string that held the two great wings of the swan to her son's arms.
Dole will sometimes do this, take a story that's been rooted in a kind of heightened mundanity, like this sort of everyday nastiness, which probably goes further than you expect, but it still feels like reality. And then right at the end, like with the child sort of falling into the carpet and then possibly disappearing. Mm. Like, I wouldn't call it a twist exactly, because it's like the story has followed the logical course of events, but then there's a point where the logic runs out, was pushed further than logic into some kind of weird dream or nightmare-like unreality.
I preferred that. I thought it worked better in The Wish than in this one, I think.
Why? Why do you think?
Because I thought that in The Wish it was kind of sort of thematically kind of coherent with like the idea of being a kid and like making up a game, and then kind of the fact that when you're really little and you don't really, the boundaries of what is reality and what's unreality are less clear, and if you kind of make up a game and then you don't, then you start to believe in it and you don't know you start to believe that it might be true, kind of thing.
And in a sense it is true, at least for the child. Like I've mentioned this before, Melanie Klein, like the Freudian psychiatrist, like child psychiatrist, wrote about this really well. This idea of fantasy with a P is what she calls that kind of blurring of fantasy and reality for the small child. It makes me think of playing, like in the carpet, it's basically playing the floor is lava.
Mm.
And how, in a sense, the floor does become lava for the child. And and it is rooted in the reality of the room. It's like, it's not just taking place in the child's head, because there's stuff in the room, like the carpet. The carpet's real, right?
Yeah.
And it kind of becomes transfigured. So did you feel like, with the swan, that was too sudden a departure then?
It might just be like, I don't know. I'm quite torn on it, actually. I think it might just be that it's a very kind of short ending coda where it goes into unreality. I like the idea of Peter having been pushed so far that his only escape is through this kind of transformation, right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure the structure of it quite works.
Yeah, because it's like, I know what you mean, because it feels like it's some kind of psychic or psychotic break, right? But then it seems to actually be happening in reality and people are seeing it. It's not really told from Peter's point of view. But then it kind of feels like a sort of intervention, right? Like grace, which is weird for Roald Dahl, and I kind of liked that, because normally Roald Dahl doesn't reach in to save his characters.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of wonder, like, I don't know, maybe it was, yeah, one of the only ways out of this story. I don't, like...
Yeah, I mean, and it is in a teenage, you know, it's such a bleak story. You do think, could he have... you can't really, it gets so dark, and then that you kind of need that, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if we've managed to convey just how nasty this story is to read.
It's really hard. Unless you read, one, it's the pacing, because it spends a long time with this horrible ordeal, and
yeah,
and that's the sense you have in this story. You just want it to stop, you know. You're like, oh God, just stop being so awful to this poor kid.
Yeah,
and I think this story kind of challenges something. I read this article, which I know you read and didn't wholly agree with, and I found it really interesting. It's an article by Joyce Carol Oates that we can link to in the show notes. And she says of the stories, particularly the later stories, that, quote, intimacy is rejected for distance, sympathy for an Olympian detachment, as if the writer were determined not to succumb to the dangers of oversensitivity like his victim characters, but to identify with their punitive and sadistic tormentors. As Dahl's books for children are often fueled by fantasies of tricks, pranks and revenge in various guises, so what really matters in his mature works is punishment. And she relates this to Dahl having been beaten and caned repeatedly at boarding school. And I guess a kind of protective mechanism where he has to harden himself as a writer to not feel too deeply the suffering that a lot of his characters go through. I don't think that's quite right. Because I feel like there is a sympathy here. It's just the bullies and tormentors in Dahl's work are so big. Like, they're so, and often physically big, right? Which obviously we can talk about is a sort of issue in his work, and has been, you know, much discussed and picked up on recently with these sort of bolderized or revised version of Dahl's books that have been put out. But often, with Roald Dahl, moral deficits are given a kind of physical form, right? So, yeah, you know, monstrous characters generally look monstrous and are often very big or overweight. Like, that's definitely a common thing in Roald Dahl. And, like, the bullies tend to be really imposing and forceful, and it's like they kind of overshadow everything else. So when I think of Matilda, particularly the book rather than the film, I do think of Miss Trunchbull first and foremost. She, like, towers over that book for me.
Yeah.
And in a way, I think that is sympathetic, because it's sort of identifying with that experience of being a child, and that presumably Roald Dahl felt being caned as a small boy, of just how massive, like, a headmaster with a cane is. And I was trying to think about the horror in Roald Dahl's stories and his stories for children. I think maybe what it is that in some of his stories... Okay, so, you know, we've talked about in a lot of children's horror, say, going right back to the Demon Headmaster, often... adult figures are unreliable and ineffective, basically. So Demon Headmaster, you've got the Demon Headmaster himself, you know, he's like this sort of cruel, Roald Dahl-like, monstrous figure. But then also you've got the parents. The parents are well-meaning, but they're just kind of useless. But then you also have this sort of tradition of, like, the orphan.
Yeah.
And the orphan then finds a new community. So, you know, in Harry Potter, for instance, yes, he doesn't have the parents, but he finds this new wizarding family. I think in Roald Dahl, you often also have that. So, you know, James of the Giant Peach, James is orphaned right at the start. Obviously, Charlie Bucket has his grandparents, but, you know, the granddad's bedbound at the start. But I think what's so odd is that often, like, these kids really do have to go it alone, and sometimes their kind of new families are just kind of really weird or creepy. right? Like, if Willy Wonka's a new father figure.
Yeah, the famous ambivalence of Willy Wonka.
Yeah, exactly. Like you've got this guy who's possibly killing kids, like, or at the very least, certainly doesn't seem to worry too much about their health and safety. In James the Giant Peach, he makes friends with a bunch of insects that are quite strange, to be honest.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's so disturbing about the Swan is that it has the characters Ernie and Raymond have this kind of almost like exaggerated cartoonish malevolence of the kind of villains in his children's books, but like the stakes are like much higher. Like, I don't know. Yeah. It's like they've kind of journeyed from the kind of heightened world of the children's books into like the real world.
Yeah, they're kind of like Flesh Lump Eater and Blood Bottler, two of the giants from the BFP, transfigured into horrible teenage boys. But that is how being bullied feels as a kid.
Yeah.
Like, I think one of the things that's hardest for anyone who's bullied is, you know, I'm sure lots of people, I'm not alone in finding this, I've talked to others about it, but when I first got like Facebook, you know, at university, and then finding like kids who bullied me at school trying to add me on Facebook, and I said, what? To me, this was so strange. Because like, you were horrible. You really ruined a lot of my childhood. And it took me quite a while to kind of realise that for them, you know, it was malarkey. Which isn't to say it wasn't serious, but for the bullies, often they did this because they were bored, or, you know, they were maybe unhappy at home and they were just sort of doing this thing. And then a lot of the time they've forgotten about it.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're the victim, you know, it can feel so massive. And there's this horrible kind of disconnect between, I think, what can feel like very kind of casual potentially for the bullies and what can feel really earth-shattering for the victim. And I think the story kind of gets that it's like Raymond and Ernie almost going through the motions, like, oh yeah, what do we do next? Okay, yeah, we'll tie him to the train track. Let's see if he gets killed.
Yeah,
there's a kind of horrible casualness about it.
Yeah
They have such kind of little moral sense. The idea that what they're doing is appalling doesn't even really occur to them. They just do it.
Yeah.
And that's really scary, because how can you reason with that? Yeah. And I think what's really disturbing is that Peter has a really canny understanding of that. He realises, he's like, there's nothing I can say.
Yeah.
He knows that these two boys cannot be reasoned with, so he kind of resigns himself. For a lot of it.
Yeah, they just have to wait it out until they get bored.
Yeah. That must be how Roald Dahl felt, regularly being caned and having a horrible time at boarding school.
Yeah, did you ever read his autobiographies?
I've read some of Boy, when he talks about that, doesn't he?
Yeah. I was really keen on those, like both Boy and Going Solo as a kid. I read quite a lot. I found them really interesting.
Yeah, my stepson George, they're probably his two favourite Roald Dahls.
I'm not quite sure what it was. I mean, obviously he was describing things like that were completely outside of my realm of experience.
Yeah, we've mentioned before, thankfully neither of us went to boarding school.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, like, you know, him crashing his plane in the desert and, you know, yeah.
I mean, there are some great recordings, actually, of Roald Dahl on YouTube, and I feel all right kind of recommending those, because you know, he's dead and he's a bit of a jerk, frankly, so
I mean, yeah, a lot of a jerk. And
yeah, a lot, let's be honest, a lot of a jerk.
He was very anti-Semitic. And,
yeah. So yeah. I think I wouldn't worry about listening to these on YouTube. So there's a guy called Lewis Kirk, who seems to have recorded basically every single Roald Dahl story ever.
Oh, wow, okay.
And they're all on YouTube. And he's got a nice voice. So if you're interested, I'd recommend his audiobook version. It's good.
Mm. Yeah, okay. I think... Shall we move on to anything else from the collection, The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar?
Yeah, well, we'll mention the other kind of stories briefly before we get onto the title piece.
Okay.
So there's The Boy Who Talked of Animals. Did you read that one?
I did read that one, yeah.
What did you think of it?
It's quite a nice little story. It's all right. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah.
It's basically about a boy who rescues a turtle from a West Indian island, and I think the kind of people in the West Indies are described in pretty unflattering, quite stereotyped tones.
Oh yeah, it was like
are also I guess quite ugly characters.
Yeah. It's the first story of the collection, and I was just like a bit like, oh, here we go.
I felt a bit like that too.
Yeah.
I mean, the kid kind of rescues the turtle and then goes off with the turtle. I didn't feel like there was much to it. Like, I was expecting some kind of a twist that doesn't really come. There's a stronger story called The Mildenhall Treasure.
Yeah, I didn't read much of this collection, which is poor form of me for the podcast. I got to the bit where, I'll chalk it down to a like an envy injury, because I got to the bit where Roald Dahl was saying about how when he was a young man he used to like publish 2 short stories a year and live off the proceeds, and I had to go and lie down for several weeks and I couldn't finish the book.
Yeah, so. Those days are long past, I'm afraid. Sorry. But this one's based on a real event, and he claims to have interviewed the man who found the Mildenhall treasure, which seems quite possible, and it reads journalistically enough with some embellishments. And I quite like it set in Suffolk, where I'm from, and so the kind of flat, grey Suffolk landscape is quite nicely described. And I think it's a nice one for any fans of The Detectorists.
Which,
if you're an American listener, you probably won't know, but it's a really... really lovely British series set in Suffolk about some metal detectorists basically trying to find Anglo-Saxon treasure, and makes lots of good use of the Suffolk landscape and has Toby Jones and Mackenzie Crook in it.
We didn't watch that together. No, it was later than that, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, it's I only watched it a couple of years ago, actually.
Okay, yeah, I must have watched it with Ava, I think.
Yeah, it's charming, it's nice.
Yeah.
You have The Hitchhiker, which is one I remember from watching Tales of the Unexpected, which was the sort of TV anthology series, so in the style of like Black Mirror, which were generally adaptations of Roald Dahl's stories, often introduced by Roald Dahl himself at the start. And The Hitchhiker is about this foxy man who's picked up as a hitchhiker, and... it turns out to be a fingersmith, which is a fancy way of saying a pickpocket.
Oh, yeah, I did read that one.
Yeah, and the pickpocketing helps get him and the protagonist out of some trouble.
Yes, he has incredibly fast fingers.
Yeah, it's quite a light, fairly charming story. There's not much to it. There's Lucky Break, which is a sort of autobiographical account of how Roald Dahl became a writer, which is definitely interesting if you've read Roald Dahl. And then that's followed in the collection, lastly, by A Piece of Cake, which is his first published book, his first story, he says, which is about him being shot down as a pilot. And actually goes into this strange dreamlike reverie after he's been shot down, which is genuinely quite hallucinatory. Quite unlike him. You know, it's very different. I can see why Joyce Carol Oates talks about how his style becomes more detached, because this feels very sensory and embedded in the experience of this pilot. Autobiographical, I think. It's mostly a descriptive piece. There's not much of a story to it, but it's a pretty remarkable piece of description, actually. It's worth reading. Quite different from what he writes later. And one nice thing, Ian, you get to see his handwriting in the piece of cake. He sort of writes about how his children book ideas come about, and he says he's got this much worn red covered volume in which he jots down ideas, often, you know, waking up in the night or by the side of his bed. And it is remarkable how simple the ideas behind his stories are. He says he wrote down, "What about a chocolate factory that makes fantastic and marvellous things with a crazy man running it? This became Charlie and the Chocolate Factory." there's another one. Henry Sugar, which we'll go on to now. "A man acquires the ability to see through playing cards. He makes millions at casinos." That's it. This became Henry Sugar. They're quite simple ideas at their heart. But Henry, he extends this with Henry Sugar, because novella length, it's easily the longest story in the collection.
It's pretty long. And it's him specifically not writing a horror story or a grisly story, because he'd been accused of writing too many horrible stories, apparently, which is a fair accusation. It's about an idle rich son of a wealthy father who's living out his days in gambling and games, and he comes across a pamphlet called "A Report on an Interview with Imrat Khan, a Man Who Can See Without Eyes." And this pamphlet goes on to detail how Imrat Khan gained advanced yogi powers that enabled him to see without using his eyes. Henry is blown away by this and the implications for his gambling, and devotes himself for years to learning these techniques. Interesting thing is that it's sort of, the story seems as if he's going to have a comeuppance or a grisly ending, and it doesn't, but Dahl can't actually resist putting the grisly ending in the story and presenting it to the readers as... He says, "What would happen
as an alternative ending?" It's like, if I was going to write a horrible ending, this is what it would be like.
I think it's worth reading, because it's quite.
Please do. And actually, when I mentioned this collection to Antonia that we were doing it, she said, I said, it's not really horror though, and she said, well, there is a bit of body horror in it, if I remember, and I'm pretty sure it must be this bit that she was referring to.
Now, had this been a made-up story instead of a true one, it would have been necessary to invent some kind of a surprising and exciting end for it. It would not be difficult to do that. Something dramatic and unusual. So before telling you what really did happen to Henry in real life, let's pause here for a moment to see what a competent fiction writer would have done to wrap the story up. His notes would read something like this. 1. Henry must die. Like Imrat Khan before him, he had violated the code of the yogi and had used his powers for personal gain. 2. It will be best if he dies in some unusual and interesting manner that will surprise the reader. 3. For example, he could go home to his flat and start counting his money and gloating over it. While doing this, he might suddenly begin to feel unwell. He has a pain in his chest. 4. He becomes frightened. He decides to go to bed immediately and rest. He takes off his clothes. He walks naked to the cupboard to get his pajamas. He passes the full-length mirror that stands against the wall. He stops. He stares at the reflection of his naked self in the mirror. Automatically, from force of habit, he begins to concentrate. And then, 5. All at once he is seeing through his own skin. He sees through it in the same way that he saw through those playing cards a while back. It's like an x-ray picture, only far better. An x-ray can see only the bones and the very dense areas. Henry can see everything. He sees his arteries and veins with the blood pumping through them. He can see his liver, his kidneys, his intestines, and he can see his heart beating. He looks at the place in his chest where the pain is coming from, and he sees, or thinks he sees, a small dark lump inside the big vein leading into the heart on the right-hand side. What could a small dark lump be doing inside the vein? It must be a blockage of some kind. It must be a clot. A blood clot. 7. At first the clot seems to be stationary. Then it moves. The movement is very slight, no more than a millimetre or two. The blood inside the vein is pumping up behind the clot and pushing past it, and the clot moves again. It jerks forward about half an inch. This time, up the vein towards the heart. Henry watches in terror. He knows, as almost everyone else in the world knows, that a blood clot which has broken free and is travelling in a vein will ultimately reach the heart. If the clot is a large one, it will stick in the heart, and you will probably die. That wouldn't be such a bad ending for a work of fiction, but this story is not fiction. It's true. The only untrue things about it are Henry's name and the name of the gambling casino. Henry's name is not Henry Sugar. His name has to be protected. It still must be protected. And for obvious reasons, one cannot call the casino by its real name. Apart from that, it is a true story. And because it is a true story, it must have the true ending. The true one may not be quite so dramatic or spooky as a made-up one could be, but it is nonetheless interesting. Here is what actually happened.
Right, I mean, that's definitely our
claim of the week.
Yeah. I should Coco. True story indeed. And I have
And what actually happens apparently is that Henry became a philanthropist, employed a Hollywood makeup artist to travel with him to so that he could visit casinos in expert disguise, and used his winnings to build orphanages.
And this is the title story that Wes Anderson's been adapting, or is in the process of adapting, for a short Netflix series.
Yeah.
And that makes perfect sense to me. Like, if you think of the Royal Tenenbaums or the Darjeeling Limited or other Wes Anderson films, he loves the eccentric idle rich.
Mm.
And, yeah, you can totally see why the character of Henry Sugar would appeal to Wes Anderson.
I feel like he enjoys a story within a story as well.
He does like these kind of nested stories, absolutely. And even though I think the Darjeeling Limited is possibly his weakest film, it shows he does have some interest in India.
Yeah, isn't the Grand Budapest Hotel, isn't it?
Yeah, it has elements. I like that one, actually. I like the model work a lot.
Yeah.
Like, it's very dinky.
Mm.
So you can really see him enjoying this story, and I guess the idea of a kind of a plan that kind of works through and then goes in a slightly different whimsical direction to what you might expect. But yeah, I was thinking of what else. So there was some confusion, actually. I saw online this week there's confusion where a website ran with the headline that Wes Anderson's Netflix film, The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar, is just 37 minutes long. And then he kind of clarified that, well, no, actually, that's the title story. And I think the issue is that you've got this collection, The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar, which is also the name of the story, right? And
yeah.
Confused about which one he's adapting. So my understanding is that that's going to be the first episode, or one of the episodes of 4, which means that there are 3 more adaptations from this book. Now,
okay.
I don't think that Wes Anderson's going to adapt The Swan.
Yeah.
It's very strange to imagine The Swan, a story about a boy being horribly, relentlessly bullied, in Wes Anderson's pastel-coloured, symmetrically framed, picture-perfect style.
I can't picture it. It's too grubby. It's too nasty.
It would be really weird if he does it. Just very using very delicate model work to depict a swan's wings.
I mean, I can see him like I can see that the image of the train coming towards the boy on the train tracks appearing to him, maybe, but
sort of adventurous music on the soundtrack, maybe.
But I it would be an odd fit.
I mean, I kind of hope he does, just because it would be weird, but I think it's much more likely that he's going to be adapting The Hitchhiker, because Royal Tenenbaums has a con man. He likes these kind of slightly amoral, but genial, like charismatic crooks, basically.
Yeah.
So I think Hitchhiker he'll do. The Boy Who Talked of Animals, I don't think there's much to it, personally, so I don't know if he'll make a great adaptation.
Yeah.
But we know from The Life Aquatic that he does like aquatic creatures.
Oh, yeah.
And that one obviously has the underwater creatures animated by Henry Selick.
Oh, yeah. You could get some good turtle animation.
Exactly. Yeah, it'd be nice if he collaborates with Selick again for that.
Mm.
And then I'm not sure, like, maybe the Mildenhall treasure. You know, I'd love to see him set something in Suffolk, although obviously with Fantastic Mr. Fox, that was a very kind of American adaptation of Roald Dahl. But I'm not sure. I did wonder if one of the other stories will largely be kind of biographical and be about Roald Dahl and maybe Bits of Boy or something.
Yeah. I mean, I think Bits from Boy could definitely work.
Because as you said, he does like stories within stories, so I could imagine that he might have someone playing Roald Dahl narrating Henry Sugar, which then contains another story within it.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
He might do it like that, but you know, I am looking forward to it, despite some of my reservations about Roald Dahl, and I do feel I don't want to talk much about it because, you know, I don't want to sort of wade into culture war stuff particularly. But I do think that this whole business with it is Penguin, isn't it? Who put out Dahl? I feel like they're publishers. I mean, this one's Puffin.
Yeah, I can't remember. I think it's Penguin.
Yeah, but like releasing these kind of newly edited versions, which have been read by sensitivity readers. I suspect, as someone else said this to me, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was a kind of cynical ploy to attract media attention and criticism because of the rights being sold to Netflix.
Oh.
I know that's really cynical. I'm generally with
catnip for culture warrior sorts.
And to be honest, I am with Joyce Carol Oates on this. Joyce Carol Oates' tweets are a mixed bag. She's quite notorious for some really terrible tweets, including have you seen Joyce Carol Oates' stuff about skeletons?
No.
It's so funny, it's amazing. Okay, so Joyce Carol Oates, for those that don't know, is a incredibly prolific American novelist. Actually, like some of her novels, Them particularly, very much. I think she's a really skilled writer, but you know, she's very elderly now. She's in her 80s, and she can be a bit cranky, basically, and has some... She said some quite problematic things at times, but also just some very odd things.
I think she also came out swinging against transphobia, though, recently.
Oh, yeah.
In
so
her
sometimes,
Twitter, so, you know.
She does always say awful things. Like, you know, she can be pretty great. She gets really angry about people having skeletons in their windows at Halloween. Seriously, like, this is a thing. Every Halloween, she like posts irately, angrily on Twitter about how these people don't take death seriously or respect death, and and posts like angry pictures or photos, I guess she's taken in her neighbourhood, of people with happy skeletons, you know, in their windows.
Amazing.
Shaming them for it. Okay, okay.
What the hell, Diane?
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, Joyce Carol Oates has written like books based on actual like murder cases, right? You know, she's written books that use real death for her stories, right? An actual tragedy, quite a lot of times. Okay. If I'm honest, I say I like her writing. I would say Joyce Carol Oates sometimes has a tendency to exploit death, basically. apparently the real sick men or sick children in this so-called society are not those who exploit the deaths of celebrities or the suffering of Marilyn Monroe. It is people who put funny bone style skeletons in their windows at Halloween.
They must be stopped.
So yeah, it's quite funny. I would recommend looking it up because it's quite good.
Wait, I think you were talking about her for a reason other than skeletons.
Sorry. So anyway, she made the point that you can't really make Roald Dahl not offensive. She basically said, to be honest, Roald Dahl stories are quite nasty, and even if you replace the language, they're still really nasty. And I totally understand why some parents wouldn't buy their kids Roald Dahl, to be honest. I think there are better children's writers, but yeah, I also think, yeah, some of it is really outdated. And he's got his strengths as a writer, but really, if you take something like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, you know.
The version of that we all read as children was already the edited version, because the original one was too offensive.
Oh, yeah, so the original version was too racist.
The original version was too racist. Yeah, I need to remind people of this every time, because I read the original version as a kid.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, this is a story in which Roald Dahl basically punishes children for their sins, one of which is, as he sees it, eating too much.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can say Augustus Gloop isn't fat or call him something different, but he is still definitely being punished for eating too much. And I don't know, you know, I can understand if you're like, yeah, I don't know if that's a very good message. I can totally understand just choosing not to read that to your kids, to be honest. But he has his strengths, and actually, I kind of, in a way, like with Roald Dahl, right, there are some actually nice stories. So I really liked the Giraffe, Pelly and Me as a kid.
Yeah.
Which is probably his gentlest story, I'd say.
Yeah, that one's sweet. SEO Trot is...
SEO Trot's genuinely nice. And then there are, yeah, his stories for adults. And we want to mention just a couple of them outside of this wonderful story of Henry Sugar, because we started with me just reading a little bit from The Wish. And, yeah, some of his adult stories, I haven't read that many of them. Some of them are just really unpleasant and, like, misogynist. But then there are some that have stayed with me from childhood, because one of them... Lamb to the Slaughter, I studied in secondary school, and I think year 7 or year 8.
Yeah.
And I have a memory of us watching, like, one of the TV adaptations of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a couple of adaptations. There was Alfred Hitchcock Presents adaptation as well, as Tales from the Unexpected. And I think it might have been that one we saw.
You linked that to me. That's what one I
watched. Yeah. So yeah, do you want to talk about that story briefly?
Yeah, so it's about a doting wife whose a policeman husband comes home from work and tells her that he's going to leave her. And in response, she clubs him to death with a frozen leg of lamb. And then when his police officer colleagues come round and... to investigate this murder that she's reported, she serves them the murder weapon for dinner as they puzzle over the mystery. It's the perfect crime.
I do remember finding this quite... I mean, you know, not that I had any intention of murdering anyone with a leg of lamb as a kid. I didn't like the taste of lamb, for one thing. But I do remember, you know, I think as an adult reading this, I was like, oh, I don't know if it's that good a crime, really. You know, there's fingerprints. I was too cynical. But as a kid, I really bought it. I was like, wow, that is the perfect crime.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a really simple twist, but
it's kind of great.
And it's kind of great.
And then she does this little deranged giggle at the end. She gets away with it.
Yeah, that's the thing with Roald Dahl. He will let people get away with it. And maybe it's a bit of an overreaction, her killing him, but it's sort of described like she just sort of does it without almost thinking about it. She just sort of, the next thing she knows, she's clubbed him to death. And, you know, in life, people do get away with murder. Like, who knows how often, to be honest?
Well,
who wouldn't know?
Yeah.
However many true crime podcasts, you know, manage to find out these murderers years later, there's always going to be more than the true crime podcasters manage to discover.
I mean, don't say that, Adam. You'll just encourage them.
Okay, yeah. Get another hobby. Come on, become a detectorist.
Yeah.
There are better ways to get famous and make money. but that's a neat little story. And my favourite, and one of my favourite things Roald Dahl ever wrote, is the final story I think we need to cover, which is called Royal Jelly.
Yeah, do you want to do Texture of the Week before we do Royal Jelly?
I don't know, because my Texture of the Week might be a bit of a spoiler for Royal
Jelly.
Shall
we? Okay, we'll just go into Royal Jelly, do Texture of the Week at the end.
Yeah, we'll do Texture of the Week at the end for a change. Okay.
Right. So yeah, it's definitely my favourite of these stories. And,
yeah, rightly so. I'm glad our tastes converged.
probably the most children's horror as well.
Yeah.
So Royal Jelly is concerns a worried and exhausted mother, Mabel, whose 6-week-old daughter is refusing to feed, and the doctors and her husband, Albert, are just telling her not to worry, but she's getting frantic. He's an avid beekeeper, and he settles down to read his latest bee magazine to distract himself from his fretsome wife, and begins to read an article on Royal Jelly. This article explains the process by which the royal jelly is fed to the larvae who are destined to become queens, and it gives the analogy that the amount of royal jelly they're fed, it's as if a 7.5-pound baby should increase to 5 tons in 5 days. From reading this line, inspiration strikes. He calls for Mabel, but she's too exhausted to respond, so he just says that he'll take care of the next feeds, and he begins to mix the royal jelly into the milk as he's preparing it. Lo and behold, once he's mixed the royal jelly into her feed, the baby takes to it right away and starts to look plumper and healthier immediately, and Mabel is overjoyed. And it's only the next evening that she remembers that Albert wanted to tell her something. And after much teasing, she finally gets it out of him that she's feeding the baby royal jelly. She's outraged. Even Albert's lengthy explanation of royal jelly and how he has converted his hives to producing it does little to mollify her. But she does notice during his explanation of his royal jelly making and beekeeping, that her husband's starting to look a bit like a bee himself. they realise they've been talking so long that they've overrun on feeding the baby. And again, Albert prepares the milk, and again, the baby sucks it all down and then wails for more. And they give her extra milk and she drinks it all. And Mabel says, I assume there wasn't any royal jelly in this last feed we've given her, but of course there was. And when Albert goes to pick up the baby, he marvels at how big and round and heavy she's got. And when they go and lay her down to change her, they see that it's her abdomen and her body has grown very big and round, but her limbs are still like thin and weedy, and there's a trail of fuzz growing across her belly. And it's only then that Albert admits to Mabel that he's been feeding himself royal jelly for the past year. Do you want to read the ending of it?
Yes, well, this is my texture of the week, so should we do a little jingle?
All right, yeah.
I'll get my rattle. Texture
of the week!
Yeah. So, in the Tales of the Unexpected episode, the actor playing the beekeeper starts getting this awful, bristling, downy fuzz on his arms poking out from under his cuffs.
Yeah.
This is how it goes in the story. So, Albert is talking about the royal jelly. The very first time I ever read that sentence, Mabel, I jumped straight out of my chair, and I said to myself, it will work with a lousy rat, I said. There's no reason on earth why it shouldn't work with Albert Taylor. He paused again, craning his head forward and turning one ear slightly in his wife's direction, waiting for her to say something. But she didn't. And here's another thing, he went on. It made me feel so absolutely marvellous, Mabel. And so, sort of completely different to what I was before that. I went right on taking it, even after you'd announced the joyful tidings. Buckets of it I must have swallowed during the last 12 months. The big, heavy, haunted-looking eyes of the woman were moving intently over the man's face and neck. There was no skin showing at all on the neck, not even at the sides below the ears. The whole of it, to a point where it disappeared into the collar of the shirt, was covered all the way around with those shortish, silky hairs, yellowy, black. Mind you, he said, turning away from her, gazing lovingly now at the baby, it's going to work far better on a tiny infant than on a fully developed man like me. You've only got to look at her to see that. Don't you agree? The woman's eyes travelled slowly downward and settled on the baby. The baby was lying naked on the table, fat and white and comatose, like some gigantic grub that was approaching the end of its larval life and would soon emerge into the world, complete with mandibles and wings. And thus Bee Baby was born!
Oh, I mean, you missed the last line.
What? What's the last line?
Why don't you cover it up, Mabel? He said. We don't want our little queen to catch a cold.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah, that is good. I think Roald Dahl should have written more about bee babies.
Yeah.
More about the bee baby.
Yeah. Love a bee baby.
Yeah. So yeah, any sort of last thoughts?
No.
it's a bit of a hodgepodge of a collection, to be honest.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Do you think there's any further Tales of the Unexpected ones we should do at some point?
Maybe. Although they're not really children's horror, and I feel like we've kind of covered the ones that are maybe appropriate for kids, like some of them are a bit skeezy in that way. Not like awful, but like,
yeah,
I don't know, a bit lowbrow perhaps. There is maybe some more Roald Dahl to do. I do want to do Charlie in the Great Glass Elevator.
Yeah, we should.
especially if there's a film adaptation.
Oh, God.
I hope there will be, with all these Netflix adaptations. That's the one
I've been waiting for. That book is so upsetting.
Yeah. I mean, what I'd love is Henry Selick to do it.
Yeah.
That would be amazing. And I would like to do the BFG at some point, particularly the old animated version.
Oh, that was so... Oh, I love that.
Yeah. I haven't actually seen the Steven Spielberg version.
No, me neither.
But yeah, I think BFG and... I mean, I know a lot of people sort of say, talk about Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, like the film, as children's horror. But if I'm honest, I think it's only really the boat ride.
Yeah.
Like, the boat ride is properly freaky. But I don't actually think... It really is, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah. No, it really is, yeah.
But I don't feel like the rest of the film is, personally.
Maybe it's just
because Gene Wilder.
It's just Gene Wilder being a little weird goblin, but
yeah, I think it's mostly because of his performance.
Yeah,
which is why the Tim Burton version didn't really work for me.
Because
you've got Johnny Depp doing a Michael Jackson impersonation, which is just
less appealing.
Well, yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And I just don't think he thought it through. I think it's just like an idea he had. It was like, oh, that would be a neat thing to do, and then he just went with it.
Yeah.
But just because something's a neat idea doesn't mean it will actually work.
Yeah.
I don't know. I get a bit sad because I love early Tim Burton films so much. Like I've been getting to do a bit of kind of film studies with the support centre, basically. The support centre at the school. So these are kids who are just struggling to access mainstream education for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been given permission to do a bit of film studies with them to prepare them for if they want to do it at GCSE. And I've basically indulged myself, if I'm honest. I've done Coraline, and I've also done some of Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which is Tim Burton's first feature-length film, and I love it so much.
Yeah.
Like, I really, really do love early Burton films, and I don't know, it gets to about Sleepy Hollow, and I do feel the wheels come off, and then you get stuff like Alice in Wonderland and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And I just remember seeing Charlie and the Chocolate Factory at the cinema and being so disappointed.
Yeah.
I've come around to it a little. I have seen it since, and it's got some interesting things, but I don't know. Have you seen any of Wednesday? Because I haven't.
No, not yet. Although Ava was potentially interested in doing it for the podcast.
Okay, I mean, we probably should, and who knows? Maybe it'll rekindle my love for Burton.
I have something to plug for this.
Oh episode. My gosh, yeah, and it's really good as well, so please.
Yeah, it's actually relevant. I have a short story in the third issue of an anthology called Archive of the Odd, which is horror and kind of other fantasy sort of stories told in unusual formats. For example, a course syllabus or a doctor's chart or a contract. I don't know. You know, whatever. Things that aren't prose.
or for you, a series of Amazon reviews.
Yes, yeah. In my case, a series of Amazon reviews. It's just come out, and it's a very lovingly put together PDF by the editors with where they've done all these fun layouts for each of the stories and illustrations. And I really recommend it, not just because I'm in it. It's really good, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes.
Yeah, I've bought it, and I've only read Ren's story so far. I'm going to read more, but yeah, Ren's story was really wonderful. I genuinely really enjoyed it, so I would recommend it.
Yeah, thank you, Adam. All right. Thanks for listening. You can email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com if you want to recommend things that we cover, like Dave did, and then we did cover it eventually.
So how long did it take us,
right? You know, we don't need to talk about that. It's fine. But
I think they've still listened, you know.
Well, what we his suggestion was the Grinny, and
we did that.
We did that, and he said he listened to it. So, okay. so yeah, if you want to be like Dave, then you can email us and suggest things. We are technically still on Twitter, still scared pod. Gotta be honest, I don't go on it very often.
Good for you.
I'm
not on it either.
I post when we have a new episode, I can't really handle
that
much Twitter. Like, yeah.
I'm just on Discord talking about horror games with the cool kids. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
To be honest, they say things.
I'm on Be Real.
What's even that?
Oh, I love Be Real. Be Real's the best social media. It prompts you to take a photo at a different time each day, and it takes like two photos, one with the front camera and one with the back camera, so you get like a selfie and like whatever you're doing at the time.
I see.
Yeah.
Is it related to bees?
No.
Oh, no. Okay. I thought maybe because of the royal jelly story.
Oh. No, sorry.
Okay. So anyway, Joe... Yeah. And
So our intro music is by Maki Yamazaki, our outro music is by Joe Kelly, our artwork's by Letty Wilson. I'll put all their details in the show notes. And do you have a sign off for us, Adam?
Yeah, be like Dave and eat royal jelly, creepy kids.
Catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.